Coming up, Dana Delaney joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
That's right. Hi, everyone. I'm Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Bird.
Hi.
How you doing today?
I'm good. I have missed you this week.
Thank you. I missed you, too. I missed you.
Truly.
You and your snacks. We always...
We always have snacks.
We always have snacks. We combine. We're like George Costanza. We're instead of sex and food, it's movies and food.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes when I'm late here, it's because I'm busy making snacks. It happens.
I know, me too. I feel such guilt. Last night, I was like, I gotta make the peanut butter with the cup.
You know, you make delicious peanut butter. You notice I took last week's extra and took it home with me. I did not leave it. So
I'm thrilled.
I took it with me. Yeah, absolutely.
See, for people out there, they should know that when they come on our show, we will feed you.
Oh, and they're not ordinary snacks.
No,
not at all.
It's not like free.
Homemade, delicious,
pretty,
yes,
all sorts of fruit.
Absolutely,
it's great.
So I was thinking about this.
Yes.
Dana Delaney is on the show, and she is one of the actors who has transitioned between TV and film.
Mm-hmm.
So with this being, a lot of people are calling now the golden age of television because there are so many outlets and opportunities for people, right?
Yes.
So you have worked in both.
I have.
I would like you to talk about the difference between the two media.
Well, I'm a purist, and I prefer film.
You do.
I know that... This is called the golden age of television. I'm the... I don't buy it. I think...
Really?
I think... You know, we have this need in our society to make everything we're doing currently...
best
like
and
Zumba,
most.
Like, it's the best. Well, there was maybe many things before Zumba. But so for me, I think the golden age of television was, in fact, the original golden age of television, mm-hmm. which was, you know, John Frankenheimer and Patty Chayefsky and Sidney Lumet was mm-hmm. directing and Rod Serling was writing. Horton Foote, great playwright, was when I used to go to acting school, I lived at the Museum of Broadcasting right near the Neighborhood Playhouse. Oh, my God. My roommate and I, every day we were watching live, these archival footage of the live television shows. And for me, personally, that is the golden age of television. And what's interesting about that time period was that in terms of Hollywood, films were changing and CinemaScope. There was also the Blacklist, which hurt a lot of careers. So a lot of people moved east. They were doing theater. And the golden age of television came from these Broadway actors,
right?
Broadway playwrights moving into television.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have now, it seems, is, yes, you have all these great stars from films transitioning to television,
mm-hmm.
but because there aren't any great film roles.
Right.
And I still, for me personally, I like a 2-hour journey
mm-hmm.
of a film. I like a beginning. I love a good story. I love a beginning, a middle, a high point, an end, and then, you know, the walk home alone in the rain where you can go, what the hell did I just happen? What did I just see? Like the movie The Lobster. We could spend the whole show talking about The Lobster because I was like, well, is it brilliant? Is it horrible? I don't know. Is it disturbing? It's my two favorite thing words, unsettling and disturbing. But that's what I love. So I am a purist. I love the cinematic journey. I do love watching television. I mean, I certainly loved Mad Men. I love the Sopranos. For me, a show like The Sopranos or Six Feet Under probably came, for me personally, the closest to great, epic television.
Mm-hmm.
And then before that, you know, Mary Tyler Moore and All in the Family. But it seems like, again, different to what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
My issue with television now is that all these great directors that are directing in television, it's still it feels a little flat for me. For me personally, even though I sit there and I watch it and I love it,
yeah.
And it's and again, there's so many shows out there that are really, really good, and the writing is really good. So I feel like there's something wrong with me. Like, huh? Why am I not as excited to see this, you know, major film star in this role? Why do I still prefer her?
John,
do you have a theory?
Yes,
this
sure.
Is our, because, one of our producers, John.
Yes. Is it because of the experience of actually going to a theater where you're in that huge room, the lights go down, and as opposed to TV when you're mostly at home and, you know, there's all kinds of other things? Do you think it's partly that because of the context in which you see the film?
I definitely think so. And again, I think that the aura of the star. You know, I'm. You know, the star turn,
and because they're
exactly.
Huge on the,
you know, when you see them on the small screen, yeah. It's a little unsettling. I remember there was this show, the show about Broadway, and it was going to be such a big deal because Angelica Houston was going to be in it.
Smash. I covered AfterBuzz for that show. Yeah,
and I was. You know, and. Please forgive me because, boy, nobody loves Broadway more than me, Broadway. I mean, I take a Broadway
jazz
class. I'm obsessed with Broadway. And I just watched the show and I was like, God, I love Angelica Houston. But I was like, it's just that impact. It's not cinematic. I
will say, I think on that show in particular, mm-hmm. It felt to me, because like I said, I did the AfterBuzz for it, so we've talked a lot about it. It felt to me like there were a whole lot of producers putting their input in that show, because it was going one way and then it would go another way. And I was continually throwing my implausibility flag when I was watching that show. It just seemed to me like so much, it was so hard just to suspend disbelief. Because they would just all of a sudden some crazy ass, you know, plot point would come up, and it felt like, you know, so many people sticking their spoons in the batter, you know, and really taking it off. But can we talk about like the difference between for preparation as far as like acting goes when you're in TV versus film?
Well, again, for me personally, I prefer the experience of film.
Yeah.
Because you can measure your performance in a 2-hour sequence, you know, it's like doing a Broadway play, you know, okay, this is going to be the highlight and this, I'm going to do this. And I just love the whole contemplative experience of driving to a film set, listening to music, talking to the director in the morning, what the scene is going to be about, where the scene lands in terms of the 2-hour structure.
On TV, you don't get that at all.
No, television is like, come on, we need to go. You know, you're like, you're just a tiny cog in the wheel of a machine.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to feel, even when you're on a top show, as if you're an important part of the structure, unless you're the star of the show.
Right? Let me ask you this then, because that's when you're in a weekly.
Yes.
Because now that, you know, Netflix, all these other platforms are opening up, they're not confined to that weekly schedule necessarily. I mean,
they all get released all at once.
And they can't, I mean, obviously they have a schedule because they have, you know, productions and they have, you know, budgets and all that other stuff. But I don't, experience of that is that they're not as confined. Would you think that that would lend itself to being more similar to a film experience?
Well, it doesn't feel like there are those highs, that real high that you get from doing an incredible scene in a movie and everyone goes, oh my God, that was incredible. And, you know, that's lunch or that's a wrap, you know. And
let's go.
There's just something glamorous about movie making.
Yeah.
And when you drive on the lot of like a 20th Century Fox, and even if you've been asked to be, and I'm going to, as soon as, it's funny, I'm going to go mid-sentence and suddenly disagree with myself.
Perfect.
You know when I felt that way? Was when I was doing Entourage. Boy, what a glamorous, you just drove up to the lot and you saw 80,000 trailers.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, I'm an important show.
Yeah.
But that's the kid in me. I'm like, oh my God, I'm on Entourage.
It felt
very glamorous and fun. Jeremy Piven is incredible and created such a incredible character. And so it really felt fun to be a cog in the wheel in that show. And because then it's like you're playing with the Yankees, now the Cubs, where you're like, wow, let me hit a home run. Yeah. I really, you know, when I was going to be on the show, I really, you know, tried to. And again, Doug Ellen, who ran that show, kudos to him, because when I came on to do the show, you just pray. You go in there and like I said, you just want to give your all. And somebody like Doug Ellen, you know, you throw some stuff out there, and sometimes the director goes, all right, you know what, Ileana, just do the lines. Okay, please, we got lunch here.
Cut.
But, you know, I started, you know, having fun and doing improv, and he was like, oh, this is terrific. This is great. Just keep it up. And boy, there's nothing, you know, that's what I learn about being a director myself, creating that atmosphere where people don't feel afraid and they really want to give their best. But most of the time, again, when I've done television shows, I feel a huge money pressure that they've got to get this scene because they've got 20 other scenes. And you're there, and I always feel like I'm trying to sneak in something funny or do something interesting. Or, you know, oftentimes, again, this lie that they tell actors, so wonderful, but like we all know it's not true, is they always say if you do a great job, they're going to have you on as a regular. They always say that. That's always the hook. It's never once happened to me, and I've been in show business since 1987. I'm still waiting for that to happen.
We have Dana coming in now. Yes. I just want to say quickly that did you ever watch the show Justified on FX?
Yes.
Amazing show. I ran into one of the actresses from that show last week and was talking to her about it, and she was saying, hey, Dana, I'll get out of your way in just a second.
Yes.
She was talking about how much she missed the show because it was really like that family atmosphere, because you keep going for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yes.
You know?
And you're celebrating a Christmas thing. So I want to do...
Okay, let's bring Dana.
I want to talk about my friend Dana, who you may know, how I first saw. I actually first saw you in a Paul Schrader film.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because I used to work for Peggy Siegel. And
that's right.
And Paul Schrader was a client, so that's how I discovered you. But, of course, your Emmy-winning role on the Vietnam drama China Beach, as well as many film appearances such as Tombstone, Fly Away Home, Wide Awake, and, of course, Desperate Housewives. You were amazing on Desperate Housewives. And she is an amazing actress who loves to play complicated characters.
Who doesn't?
Please welcome Dana Delaney, and most recently, Hand of God.
Yes.
Which was also, we were just talking before you got here about the transition away from movies to things happening on television and whether or not it's the golden age of television. I said I'm a purist. Like, for me, the golden age of television was the 50s.
The 50s, yeah.
And this is good. I like this. It's great. I love that people are working, but...
It seems like every age is a golden age of television. Don't they always use that phrase?
Well, the last time they said that Mary Tyler Moore was sort of like the great sitcom, know. But your experience of working on, it's a classic question, but the experience of working on television versus working on films, do you have a preference?
I think as a woman, I think TV's better. I've always thought that. Mm-hmm. You know, especially as you get older. But I just think, you know what it's like now in major movies? You're just the supporting character. You're the wife, the girlfriend, whatever.
You're the one behind the door, I always say.
Yeah, you're the one saying, honey, are you sure? Do you think so?
You're the supportive wife. You're the horrible ex-wife.
Yes, exactly.
I'm always the horrible ex-wife.
At least that's more interesting.
That's what I was going to say. At least that's a more interesting character other than standing there just looking pretty.
Oh, honey.
You know?
I'm worried.
Exactly. Exactly.
I come in and get to yell at the comedian. I've done a lot of those.
But the one who gets to hold the knife a lot of times, you know?
Yes. So we always start the show off with it's my favorite question of all time, of course, because I thought of it, is Natch. Is do you remember the first movie you saw, and who took you to see it?
You know, the one that sticks out, I'm not sure it was the first one, but was The Music Man.
Really?
Yeah. Oh.
With Robert Preston.
Yes. 1962. So I was 6 years old.
Wow.
And I loved it so much. And those were the days where you got the album, you know?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I remember at that age memorizing the whole album. And I know I did because when I went to school, probably first grade, I asked the teacher whether I could sing Goodnight, My Someone to the class. And I've never had the nerve to do something like that again in my life. I don't know how I got it then. But I got up and sang the song. I think all the kids were looking at me like, what? Why aren't we listening to this girl do this?
Did you do show and tell?
Yes.
I wonder if they still do that. That usually, that for someone who's like a budding actor,
yeah.
I think that's where it begins with, like, I was obsessed with show and tell. Like, and if somebody had something better than me, I'd be like, God damn it. I remember once I had made an entire terrarium, you know, and I was like,
oh, yeah.
And then this stupid kid in my class brought in a rooster.
And I was you can't totally beat a rooster. Upstaged you.
You can't beat the cock.
Yeah. They were like,
thank you, Dana.
Thank you. She's working blue. But I love that. So early on, and then who took you to see The Music Man? I love hearing.
I really got my love of movies from my father. So it probably was my father, you know, grew up in Brooklyn in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And that was when you could see five movies a day, and he did.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And he kept a diary, which I still have. Aww. And he would rate the movies and write little reviews. He would just sit in the cinema all day long, you know, and they had shows and cartoons and all that stuff. So, and then he had like big books, coffee table books of, you know, all the cast and the crew and before IMDb.
Yeah.
And I used to sit there as a kid and just memorize them, you know, like memorize who the customer was and who the cameraman was and all that stuff. Yeah, I was obsessed.
Oh, I love, well, yeah, we used to have all those great movies. I mean, I still have a lot of my movie books. I would do that same thing where you'd look at the picture. Well, one of my favorites was Life Goes to the Movies.
Oh, I remember that.
And I would go through and every photograph. So if there was a photograph of Jack Lemmon from the days of Wine and Roses, like it was in sections. So there'd be like war movies, this kind of, you know. Then one section was like kind of, you know, heartache. Yeah. So there was Rock Hudson from Seconds, Jack Lemmon, Days of Wine and Roses. I didn't even know what the movies were.
Right.
But like I'd look at the image and then I'd have to check off in my life like, okay, now I've
seen Seconds. One. Yeah.
I've seen this one, you know. Did you have actors or actresses you were obsessed with? Everybody knows about mine. I wrote about that. I was obsessed with Richard Dreyfuss.
Right.
I was obsessed.
Yeah.
I literally pretended he was my friend. And then he became.
And now he is.
And I know. I stalked him until he eventually accepted me.
Until he gave in.
I was a little weird. I mean, you and I grew up in the age where you had the 4:30 movie.
Yes.
So you would just. I never went out to play. I was never outside. I was home on the couch eating and watching the 4:30 movie. You know. And my friends used to say, God, you went through a whole bag of Fig Newtons. I mean, I was just known for that. But I was like the second lead. I didn't like the lead. I found the second lead more interesting. Like in Singing in the Rain, I liked Lena Lamont better than Debbie Reynolds, you know. And my favorite was Gloria Graham. I was obsessed with Gloria Graham.
Really?
Yeah.
What Gloria Graham movie?
Well, In a Lonely Place is my favorite movie.
That's your favorite movie?
That's my favorite movie, yeah.
I'm obsessed with that movie. I just wrote about it for the Criterion Collection. You got to be careful showing this.
I know. People are mixed about that movie.
Yeah, very mixed.
Why?
Well, do you want to go first?
Well, it's funny. It's a very dark view of Hollywood and of relationships.
Yes.
But it's also beautiful, I think.
Yeah.
And I remember I was friends with John Calley, who, you know, was running Sony for a while. And I said, you know, we should do a remake of In a Lonely Place. And he said, yeah. And so he screened it for Mike Nichols. And Mike Nichols said to him, no.
Well, it represents, it's a film noir by Nicholas Ray. And Nicholas Ray did Rebel Without a Cause.
Okay.
Did another movie I love called Bigger Than Life, which is a similar theme in a way. So Humphrey Bogart is this alcoholic writer, and he's supposed to read this book. He's supposed to have a meeting about turning this book into a screenplay, and he's known as a brawler. And on the night that he meets this girl who's a co-check girl, and he is going to basically have her read him this book because he doesn't want it. He's so could care less, doesn't want to read it. She mysteriously is murdered. And because he's such a violent guy, he kind of gets accused of this crime. Meanwhile, the person he's in love with is Gloria Graham, who's living across in this courtyard apartment. And so she can sort of vouch for him, and they get involved in this relationship. But he starts, the more and more they get involved, the more violent he mm-hmm. becomes. And it's quite disturbing wow. how violent he becomes.
And it's really about trust. Can you really trust somebody? Can you really know who somebody is? And Nick Wray made it when his marriage to Gloria Graham was falling apart.
Yes.
Because in the original Dorothy Hughes book, he is guilty. It's, yes. It was one of the first books written about a serial killer. It's a wow. really good book.
Yeah. So in the original Dorothy Hughes movie, who wrote, I'm going to do another crossover. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a movie called Ride the Pink Horse, which is also by Dorothy?
Never seen that.
Oh, my God. Another incredible story. Dorothy P. Hughes, Ride the Pink Horse. Did the movie, Robert Montgomery, and he directed it.
He directed it?
Yeah, one of my favorite. I put it on my Criterion Top 10.
I can look at that one.
So In a Lonely Place, and because they have these interesting parallels about women and trust and
oh, wow.
how a woman can change your life. But it also sort of, again, weirdly represents a theory, an idea of like, he loves me so much that he beats me. You know, there is a little bit of an undercurrent in the movie that is like, this is supposed to be, you know, he like slaps people around right. and he's, you know, yeah. and Nick Wray, who is the director, presents this guy as that's the kind of guy you should be, you know, a real man, drinks, roughs people up. When they don't agree mm-hmm. with him, he punches them out, breaks their glasses, you know. So it does have this kind of...
But he doesn't really mean it. He's sensitive underneath yeah. it all.
And then,
isn't it amazing how those kind of attitudes just don't ever change in certain situations?
No, and you know? There's another, like, very weird undercurrent in the film with Gloria Graham, because the movie begins, and she has just moved into this courtyard apartment.
I love that whole complex. It's so Hollywood. Yeah,
it's so Hollywood. It's like, what's going on between everybody's apartment? But she has this... you know, I guess lesbian masseuse that comes
right.
over. And she keeps talking about her masseuse that comes over. She goes, yeah, she likes to beat me black and blue. And then there's a scene of Gloria Graham naked with her friend. I think her name is Martha.
Yeah.
Who's like massaging her. And she goes, we ain't going to get out of this one as easily as the last one. So you kind of get the impression that Gloria Graham goes from like, one man after another
yeah.
who...
And she chooses badly.
Yeah.
Right.
It kind of beats her. We ain't going to get out of this one as easy as the last one, you know? And it's like, ooh, jeez. What do Martha and Gloria have going, you know? But it's that dark...
But it's all so romantic. The final line, you know, is so famous.
Yes.
You know, right?
The one I died when I...
Yeah, I was born when I
yeah.
met her. I lived while... She loved me, and I died when she left.
Yes.
Yeah, something like that. I was born when she
wow.
kissed me. Yeah.
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 And, but mm-hmm. it, for certain, and I wrote about this, like, certain movies I've done, and people would ask for a recommendation, and I would have, like, a leading man. I'd be like, you need to see In a Lonely Place. And sometimes with good results, and sometimes, like, why would you send me that movie? Why would you want me
yeah.
to? You think I beat my women?
Well, this says something about me. I think it's highly romantic.
It is. It's incredible. And again, Nick
right,
Wray.
We know something about Dana now.
And because of... But what's interesting about In a Lonely Place, which is what I wrote about in the Criterion piece, is that in the next... film that he did, you know, so he and Gloria Graham break up, but then he did another film, Bigger Than Life, with James Mason, mm-hmm. in which James Mason also tries
yes.
to kill his wife.
Yes.
And again, in that film, it's this whole kind of, you know, destruction of the American family. She's like the perfect wife, and he's got this beautiful son. And again, there's this sort of pivotal scene where he goes insane and he's trying to like kill his own son, like sort of kill the American family. So I don't know, you know, Nick Wray had
definitely issues.
interesting ideas about being about masculinity, but I think Humphrey Bogart did. And again, the real life Humphrey Bogart in his marriage to
Bacall.
Mayo. They were called like the battling Bogarts, you know. So again, he had been, you know, they frequently were like brawling, drinking, and you know, this seems to be like a somewhat of an honorable thing. But it's a
he got kicked out of the high school I went to.
He did?
Yes.
And where did you grow up here?
Or in Connecticut.
He was Humphrey Bogart.
No, he went to boarding school in Andover and he got kicked out. And the rumor is it's never been verified that he threw tied a teacher to a chair and threw him in the lake.
Wow.
So who knows?
Tough guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's in high school.
Now, the did you like going to private schools? I always loved private school movies.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And books for me. I would always read those.
That is exactly why I went. I only went for my senior year, but my parents were splitting up. It was my junior year. And I was in Virginia. We'd moved from Connecticut to Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I had gone to public school in Connecticut, but the public schools were so much more advanced than the private schools in Virginia then.
Really?
That I was repeating stuff. And I reread a separate piece, which is at boarding school. And I fell in love with the idea of boarding school. So without my parents knowing it, I applied to Andover and Exeter, because Exeter was in the book. And I got in, and I didn't even know it was the first year they took girls.
Wow.
It was all just chance, the whole thing. And I went to my father and I said, can I go? He went, okay. You're a little weirdo.
Wow.
Well, it kind of changed my life.
Was it as romantic and
it was exactly
amazing.
What I wanted it to be.
Was it? Mm-hmm. Oh, isn't that fabulous?
Yeah, it really was. It was great.
And did they have an acting program?
Yeah, I did. Jimmy Spader was there when I was there.
Oh, my goodness.
He was 2 years behind me. I was in South Pacific. I was Nellie Forbush.
Wow. You
know? But it was just, you know, it was a high school.
I know, but still, that's sort of, you know, I always remember the people that did, you know, there was, like, the people that did really well in high school and in acting school, and I was never part of that.
Well, I
was always like, I'm going to start my own avant-garde theater company. We don't need you.
Yeah, but I read your book. I mean, you had chutzpah. I never had the chutzpah you had.
Really?
You just went after it. I was impressed.
You can't think of, well, I was reading about, again, you auditioned for China Beach and you didn't get it, and then you went back and
that's a whole
that's
not, it's a myth.
That's a myth. That whole thing.
Ooh, set us straight.
Set us straight.
Yeah. I don't know why people. I don't know who started that one. What happened was, and it was totally genuine because I'm not clever enough to think of this. I wanted this role so badly because it was an unusual role for a woman.
I mean,
it was amazing.
When I read the script, I thought this is Clint Eastwood. And that's who I imagined in my head, Clint Eastwood. So I was trying to stay in my head as Clint Eastwood, and I'm waiting in the outside room to go in and meet with the producer, and I'm sitting there for like 45 minutes, and he comes out, looks at me, and finally he says, "Are you Dana Delaney?" I went, "Yeah." He goes, "Come here." And I go into his room. He goes, "You're a day early." I said, "What?" He goes, "You're a day early." I said, "Okay, so you have to come back tomorrow."
Oh, wow.
And I said, okay. And I was so psyched. I was ready to read, you know? So I came back the next day and auditioned again. And then they made me audition a billion times after that. But he, I think, thought I did it on purpose to, like, get an upper
hand. You're doing like a Sean Young.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you think it worked in your favor or not?
I don't know. I mean, I got the part.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Now, I want to ask you about, you just said something which, like, people, again, don't understand. They think, like, because people say, well, you get offered things all the time. It's like, no, you audition 80 times.
And
most of the time you don't get it anyway.
Yeah.
But you talked about, because I've certainly had, I've collapsed. Like, when you get around audition number 8, I can't do it. I fold. Yeah. I don't get better. Do you, each time when you get in, do you get, when you go through that? Because it's a mental
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, back then, I really didn't know what I was doing at all. So that was just
But you know, each time you go in, there's more people in the room.
Yeah, well, especially network.
Suddenly there's 30 people watching. Yeah. It's like a coliseum suddenly.
I mean, at this point, I mean, the grace of age is I don't care.
You don't?
I do it for me now.
Really?
You know, and if I please myself, that's all I can do. Back then, it meant so much more.
That's sort of what Ed Begley Jr. talked about. You know, any opportunity to act.
Was, yes,
you know, is it's like I get to go and show these people what I do.
Yeah, I start to get in my own head when it gets into that. Okay, now you're the third. You know, this is the third time, and it's between you and somebody else. You know, it. I start to
doubt.
I went for something, and then again, it's a totally true story. You can ask him. We'll have him on and ask him. We got down to, like, I'd auditioned for this thing five times, and they said to me, this is it. This is it. It's between you and one other person. This is it. And I was like, I got this thing in the bag. I show up. My competition was Richard Lewis. We were both auditioning for the same part. And he said, let me ask you, did your agent say it's between you? It's just a matter? And I said, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Had it in the bag. I have it in the bag. So it's me getting it. And neither one of us got the part.
Oh!
And a couple days later, he called me and he told me that Wayne Knight got the part.
Well, that's a whole nother way to go.
Wayne Knight, yeah. So neither one of us, me, Richard Lewis, Wayne Knight gets the part, and that's show business. So that's what I, you know. So these days again, like you never know. But I start to freak out once it gets to the 20 people in the room.
Yeah, it's a head trip. It really is. That's where meditation and yoga comes in.
Really, mm-hmm. I always go out, walk in, and I try to make them laugh, which is probably the worst, stupidest thing.
No, I don't think that's bad at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Especially if it alleviates
your... Do you have
your...
any techniques? I'm always telling people about my techniques for auditioning.
Really? I don't... God.
God, I'm obsessed. You know, what? Way back in the day, do you remember something called the Lort auditions?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay, oh, so yeah. way back in the day, back in the 80s, I'd just gotten out of acting school, and I had done a play with the Actors Theater of Louisville. And I was in New York, and they asked me to represent the Actors Theater of Louisville for something called the Lort Auditions at Actors Equity. And it's like every, you know, theater company on the Eastern Seaboard comes.
It's terrifying.
And for 3 days, we saw, like, literally, you see 150 people.
So you were on the other side.
Yeah. And it changed my...
What year was that? Maybe I auditioned for you.
I'm going to guess, because I had just gotten out of acting school, I'm going to guess it would have been like 1986.
Okay, no, I did it earlier. I was horrible. I was terrible at that.
Here's what I learned.
So the process is you're going through like...
You sit there. So I'm representing the Actors Theater of Louisville quite seriously. Okay. You know, again, like I'm there and I'm have to look for people that would be qualified to go audition for their plays, along with, say, 15 other people that are representing the different theaters. And we saw, and I'm not kidding you, 150 auditions a day for 3 days. And what I learned out of that was, out of the hundreds and hundreds of people I saw, literally maybe 20 people were good.
And you just knew.
And so you were saying it was brutal, Dana. Why is that?
Well, you're so young at that point. You're right out of school. And you have to a serious monologue, classic monologue.
Yeah.
And
classic
then
monologue.
Contemporary, right? Yeah. Modern, yeah. And monologues are hard. Mm. Not everybody's good at those.
I know. And we had people that came in and drank a beer. We had girls that came in and did a Sharon Stone. And like I saw it all. We had one actor, bless his heart, I have, you know, you catalog things in your mind. You're like, one day I will be able to put this in a movie. But one day an older gentleman, bless his heart, literally, because the clock is ticking. You've got like 3 minutes or whatever to do this thing. And then a buzzer goes off and you go, thank you. And then they leave. this gentleman came in with a phone, because you know, we didn't have cell phones, obviously. He came in with a phone and literally was like going to do his monologue on the phone and had the cord like wrapped around. So he was unwrapping and unwrapping and unwrapping. And then he got the wire done. And then it was like unwrapping and unwrapping and unwrapping. Literally like got the phone up and was like, hello.
Oh, it's like a game show.
And he literally like looked at us pitifully. Oh. He goes, thank you very much. As if he had done the monologue. Thank you very much. And I just saw like on people like the fear, the, you know, they just didn't want to be there. It changed my life about auditioning, about how you should represent yourself.
It's a horrible process, and right? Nobody's come up with anything better.
It is, right? And I'm not good at it either. I mean, I wish, you know,
because it's not really acting. That's not what acting is.
No, you know? I think it's. But I do think it's the ability to change direction in the room. Like I know when I did, I got this call. It was the very last 10 episodes of Seinfeld. I was like, oh, my God, insane. Right. What? So they were like, oh, you got to go in right away. And they gave me a scene, and they said, this isn't even going to be the scene. They're just giving you the scene and to see what you're going to do. And I just was like, I'm going to make Jerry Seinfeld laugh. That's all I'm going to do. And I did. And everybody laughed. And he goes, all right. That was totally not what the scene is about. He goes, but let's do it again now. And do the right thing. And I did. And I think that ability to change and make him laugh, you know, but then also have the ability to follow direction.
Right.
But I try to do stuff like that. And it's risky. Maybe it's risky.
Yeah, but that's a way of making it yours.
Yeah.
You kind of head the conversation then.
I feel like I'm the only one. This is like so confessional. So, I've had the experience. I've told this story a lot because it's a true story where I had my agent go, they're either going to go black or they're going to go Ileana Douglas. And I'm like, I don't know how I can audition for that, but thank you. They're either going to go, my favorite audition story. They're either going to go black. I don't know who it's more offending. Is it
right
to the African-American community or to me? But I came in and I remember like sitting there with the two other African-American girls. And I was like, I know I'm not black, by the way. And like they did not think it was funny. Like I was like, watch how I make it my own. You know, I'm just going to try to have fun with this. And But I just try to have fun, and oftentimes people are like not having it.
Well, it's all you can do is have fun.
Yeah,
I think in the end, because it should be fun.
So I want to talk a little bit about your experience of, because you've worked with so many great directors, Paul Schrader. I mean, what was your experience? I found Paul Schrader. I worked for Paul Schrader as a film publicist.
This when you were in the Brill Building?
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So Paul Schrader had this was in the Brill Building, and I worked for the great film publicist, Peggy Siegel.
Side note, good stories in your book.
About, yes, very good stories.
Thank you. Well, she was amazing.
Recently out in paperback, people.
Yes, mm-hmm. On Amazon.
I'm going to see Peggy on Saturday, actually.
What?
Yeah.
Is this for the Warren Beatty?
No, some other event she's doing.
Peggy is the best. She's the
beer plus one. See if you can go.
The best thing I ever did was to work for Peggy Siegel because I get invited to all the great parties, which was my whole goal when I worked for Peggy Siegel. That's what my roommate. That's all I did. I was like, I get to invite Walter Cronkite to a party. Like it's the easiest job in the world. But Paul Schrader, we worked with Paul Schrader among many other people. But boy, did I find he was very intimidating. He was one of the most intimidating people I ever came across. He'd just come in like, he'd get his baggy around, and I'd be like, no, Paul, you know, I was watching. Yeah, whatever. He's just like, like, you're nobody. You're not interesting. You're not smart.
No.
You know. Oh, totally.
He's not. Danny, you worked with him on
Two movies. I did Patty Hearst and Light Sleeper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And did he intimidate you?
Oh, at first, yeah. I mean, he's not a people person. He's not comfortable.
To say the least.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, he is a super smart.
Yeah.
I like
Calvinist.
Yes, not anymore, but yeah.
Yeah.
I really liked working with him as a director because he had a point of view, mm-hmm. you know, and he had his vision. And there's not a lot of directors left like that, yeah. I think, you know, that you know this is a Paul Schrader movie. And
he seems very cerebral. Is he cerebral as a director? Like, does he say, Dana, I want you to think about this? Or
the only thing he said to me, which was sort of a total diss, was he said, you don't have to do it the same way every time.
See, like that. Yeah. That's.
And I didn't think I was. I was just, also was.
Because missing your subtlety.
Yes, right? Exactly. And I actually ended up liking the way, and I don't usually like my performances, and I liked it in that movie. So yeah. I was fine, you know.
Did you think he was doing it to get in your head, or do you think?
Yes, I think he likes play mind games. Yeah.
See, now I said this before. I have never had a good performance with someone who's trying to play mind games. The best directors I've ever worked for, Gus Van Sant, Martin Scorsese, try to create an atmosphere of trust where you go, okay, that was horrible. I know it was horrible. And everyone laughs, and then you go, all right, I swung for the fences. I'm sorry. Let me try something else. That's where, like, but the ones that are like, you know, your mother maybe did, you know. I'm like, what? What is my father have to do with this? So
No, but I have great fondness for him.
Yeah.
I do. I really do. I liked working with him. I wish he worked more. Actually,
well, his body of work that he's done is very specific. I would have to say that. And then now, what about Gary Marshall? Like broad.
Have you ever worked with him? I must have.
I have another horror story. The Ileana Douglas show. Gary Marshall, who I adore. There were two people who cursed me in my career. And now they're both gone. And I adore both of them. Harold Ramis and Gary Marshall.
Oh, wow.
Literally every film they ever did would bring me into audition. Yeah. And I'd go, I don't know. Harold Ramis, I used to like, you are not going to put me in your movie, but thank you. Yeah. I said, I'm literally at the point now where I'm coming in and I'm just going to say
hi. Did you audition
for
Groundhog Day?
Yes.
I auditioned for that.
Yeah. I auditioned for a part and got the part, and then they cut the role.
Oh, no.
I auditioned for a girl who puts a spell on Bill Murray, and I even have my script, and I went in, and Harold Ramis asked me to improv because they didn't have the script yet. But in the very beginning of the movie, he plays this jerk, and he sleeps with a girl, and you know, never calls her again, and that girl puts a spell on him, which causes the whole Groundhog Day, and I got the part, and then Harold Ramis called me and said, we've decided the movie works, you know, is going to work better without you. And they were wrong, obviously. Groundhog Day, whatever
big,
happened,
big
Bill Murray.
If only.
But now, who did you audition for the Andy?
Andy McDowell.
You auditioned for a real part. I auditioned for, like, the freak part. Like, could you put this, you know, could you do something? I would always get part, like, listen, we don't know what we're doing. Maybe if you come in, could you come in with something? So you try good. To... do that. So but
Gary,
broad.
Well, you know, that was an unusual movie for Gary, Exit to Eden, because you know, he was known for comedy, and the last movie he had done right before that was Pretty Woman, which was a huge hit.
Yeah.
And you know, the script never quite worked. It was always my side, which was the erotic drama side, and then there was the comedy side. And the Anne Rice book was all erotic drama, and it's actually really good. It's kind of like a book about how women think they're being empowered by being in control, but they're really not, and they need to let go of control.
Right.
And there was a good message in that, you know. And it kind of got lost in the sauce.
Yeah.
But the only thing, and I adored Gary, you know, he's always eating tuna fish, always had food out of his mouth. And you know, he's famous for that, and he always has his friends around laughing. But the only thing he said to me was, you don't have to be funny. Just be real. I don't need you to be funny. They're going to be funny. You just be real. And I was like, really? I could be funny? He goes, no, I just want you to be real. I said, okay, fine. So I was not that part of the movie.
Not the funny
part. Yeah, yeah. It was like two separate movies.
You also worked with Paul Mazursky.
Yes, I adored him.
Love.
On what did you work with him?
I did a movie called Moon Over Parador with Richard Dreyfuss, your hero.
Incredible movie.
And best friend of Ileana's.
Best friend. And Raul Julia, who I adored.
Oh.
Loved him. And we shot in Brazil, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
In Ouro Preto. So that was fun. And I was supposed to only be there for a week. And then somebody had a problem, so I got to stay there for 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
I was in heaven. It was great.
Yeah, I love that movie. And I love Paul. He seems like such a gentle. I did a play with him. But he was a great director. Again, quietly, you know, just said, you know, just.
Exactly.
He was like that kind of like, you know, not. Seemingly giving you direction, but giving you again an arena to work in. Do you have favorite people that you worked with,
like directors?
Yeah,
no.
Who, when you did, who was directing Desperate Housewives?
By the time I got on the show, there was really three directors that they used over and over again, which I prefer. Mm-hmm. I personally.
Yeah.
Cannot stand the TV system of having a new director every week.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because you end up being hostess to this director.
Yeah.
And worrying about them instead of your own performance. And they don't really know the show. And sometimes they're off.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that. Because, you know, as an audience member, you do see there's a different director all the time. And I've always wondered, you know, what there has to be a certain level of, you know, knowledge that they do or don't have. And what happens when they don't have it.
I think it should be two directors. That's it.
Yeah.
And just alternate. I really believe that.
Well, it certainly sets a tone, you know, again, for what the show is like. Was the show really a reflection of the showrunner, of Mark Cherry?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
So he was. Would he always be on set, or again, is it a tone is set?
No. By the time I got on, which is I think the fourth season, they had gone through some, you know, issues that they worked out, and I think the second season everybody agreed they kind of lost their way a little bit. So by the time I got on, Mark really cares about the comedy. That's what he cares about the most, and it's very specific comedy. And so he would be driven in a golf cart up to the set for every rehearsal. He'd be there for the rehearsal, and he'd go, now, this is what this is, this is what this is, this is what this is, be done, everybody got it, and then he'd leave. And then he'd come back for the next scene for the rehearsal. So he was definitely hands-on.
And Mark Cherry was, he worked on the Golden Girls, right?
Yeah.
So did he have any good, did he want it to be like what was the tone of the comedy when you said, like, he had a very specific idea of the comedy? I mean, the Golden Girls is sort of broad.
Yeah, right. It was.
He wanted
it
broad?
It was a very classic setup, joke kind of thing. He wanted to make sure, and you never moved on the joke, which is classic.
That's so funny. Yeah. That is classic.
Classic, yeah.
That's classic.
Yeah.
That is. That's hard to do, though.
Yeah, it's hard, yeah.
That's so, oh God, I love, that's very funny, Mark Cherry. Now, this is a show about Dennis Hopper, and you're the only person I know who went on a date. I'm so jealous of you.
I'm sorry.
Dish, we want to know.
You played my love interest in a movie, but I didn't get to make out with him.
You didn't.
But it would have been like making out with my father. So he played my father figure type lover in the movie.
That's so
funny.
So
you went on a date, and how did this come about? Jesus. I want your life.
Your life is pretty great, too.
Yeah, stalking Richard Dreyfuss. Your life is like, Dana's awesome. Fix you up with her.
I was friends with Brian Hamill. Do you know Brian Hamill?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, a photographer?
Yes, set photographer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Many famous films.
Yes,
worked with
he did
Woody
all
Allen.
Of Woody Allen's movies. Yes. And I just moved to L.A., and he said, you know, you should meet my friend Dennis. And I was like, and I think Blue Velvet had just come out.
Oh, good gracious.
And I was terrified.
Yeah.
Yes. Properly so.
But, you know, I mean, I knew him from Rebel Without a Cause and, you know, all those great movies and Giant, which we saw. So I'm not going to pass that up. And he had just moved into that Frank Gehry house that he lived in Venice, which I also was a Frank Gehry fan, so I wanted to see the house.
Yes.
So I said, okay. So I met him at his house, and I was terrified. I was like a schoolgirl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's big. He's like a big movie star.
Yeah.
And his daughter was there, Marin, who I think was my age, which was also little strange, yeah.
Extra layer of interesting.
And then we went to West Beach Cafe, which is where everybody went back then.
Wow. And so who's like, give us a, like, who's at some of the other tables? I love stuff like this.
Oh, back then it was all, you know, that was when all the artists went there. Like, Ed Ruscha was hanging out there. You know,
unbelievable.
Billy Al Bankston, that was the art scene.
Yeah. Mm.
But anyway, I remember I think he's shy. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think he's shy, and I'm shy, and it was kind of painful.
Yeah.
So I just kept asking him questions about old movies. Like, uh-huh. I wanted to know about Gloria Graham, and I wanted to know about her marriage to Nick Ray, and I wanted to know if it was true about her stepson and that, you know? And I don't know if you know the story, but she ended up marrying her stepson.
Oh.
It's crazy, yeah.
Yes, so he validated all of that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. He, now he also, didn't he have an affair with Elizabeth Taylor and Natalie Wood?
I knew about Natalie Wood. I didn't know about Elizabeth Taylor.
Wait, so did you go on just one date with him?
That was it.
Oh, no love connections, Chuck Lorre would say.
Yeah, I think, and we went back to his place, and he made a suggestion of romance, but I was like, I gotta go!
He made a suggestion, and then he took out this mask.
Exactly.
That would be...
His face got really red.
Did you learn anything about him, like at dinner, that sort of surprised you? Because I think, I mean, that's the challenge. How do you date a movie star?
Yeah.
How do you even become friends?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Well, I mean, the thing that you realize is he is as shy as I, you know, he was very shy and awkward. You know, I think people like that need somebody, you know, more like you, I think, who's willing to, like, you know, get them out of their shell and, you know.
Yeah,
and...
but sometimes, like, you can risk, like, them, you know, them, like, I've definitely had that where I've crossed the line where you're kidding around. You know, when I worked with Buck Henry, he was all excited, you know. I was like, so, Buck, when you did Catch 22? And, like, by the third day, I would see him with his lunch tray going, hi, Eliana, don't leave me alone, you know. But
I will say that years later, I briefly had an assistant, which I don't have assistants anymore. But you know that phase in your career, you're like, yeah, I need an assistant. Where she saw him at something, and he knew that she was my assistant. He said to her, "What's up with Dana and that exit to Eden?"
Really?
It's like it was like this whole side of me he like didn't know.
Whoa.
He was like, if I'd known then,
right?
See, it was so, you know, I don't know. Yeah, to me, it's so interesting. God, I'd kill to go on a date with Dennis Hopper.
Too late.
Yeah.
Too late. I know, all the people. Well, I turned down my big, you don't have to name names unless you really want to, but, you know, my big show business regret is not having sex with Marlon Brando. That's my, you know, but I suspect, and all my other friends.
Oh, I think
Yeah, I suspect too.
So I got the invitation.
I think so.
Got the invitation. Go to his house, and I said no. And that's my big show business regret. Do you have any show business regrets like that? If they're gone, maybe it was Dennis Hopper.
No.
he's scarred for life. You know, they have penicillin too.
You mean like where you had a chance and you didn't go?
Yeah,
for
was
it?
There? Whoa, set romances? Do you ever do set? I am against them. But how do you feel?
I used to. I don't believe in them anymore.
They're a menace.
Yeah, they do. I had one relationship work out. One. That was good.
That from a set romance?
Yeah.
Wasn't like the movies. You know, again, deep regrets of I've had the opportunity and I just didn't do it. I was too much of a purist. I didn't want to ruin the movie.
Yeah. I tended to have affairs with the camera assistant.
Interesting. Oh, so you were one of those.
Because
one of those.
Or the focus puller, because they're just watching you so intently, you know?
So interesting. You know, a lot of actresses have had relationships with their cameraman. I mean, Julia Roberts is her husband.
Oh, right.
But I've seen, so you see the two. I remember being on a movie, and I was once again on the outside looking in. Through the fog. But yeah, the DP was totally in love with my co-star and, you know, lighting her beautiful. And I kept trying to get him to look at me. Yeah. Care less about me.
Well, I think DPs are fascinating because it's the left brain, right brain thing. You have to have both to be a cinematographer. Yeah. And I find that fascinating.
Yes.
You know, you have to be an artist, but also understand the mechanics.
Yes.
And I think that's a really smart person.
Yes. I always went for the director. That was my, you know.
Aim high.
I wasn't as interested. I love actors. I love them, but they're a little bit just too much in love with themselves. Mm-hmm. And the director, felt like I became like, you know, they would have somebody at his shoulder to cry on or something. So I always kind of enjoyed that, you know, being in that position. So we just did our show. Let's talk a little bit about Trailblazing Women in Film for TCM. That's how we met doing the show. It just ended. It was it's such an honor every year to do.
You got some great people.
Oh, my God. I mean, Jane Fonda.
What a thrill for you.
Bette Midler, Dana Delaney. Well. Getting to talk to people. My mom was so excited. Well, I always like everything for me is really about my mom. She's like, did you tell Dana that we're from Connecticut? The first thing I did.
Did you tell her we discussed drive-in movies?
Yes. It's all she wants to. She's like, every time I talk to her, I go, I'm seeing Dana today. Did you tell her that we go to Beach Donuts down in Clinton and their picture is there?
You know, I got to tell you, though, speaking of your family, I just watched a movie with your grandfather that I'd never seen, Third Finger Left Hand.
Yes.
With Myrna Loy.
Yeah.
My God, he was hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
Because I knew him in his later movies where he was more serious. Yeah, like I Never Sang for My Father and being there. But he was so goofy.
He was. He was very, very silly and goofy. And I love that part of him. I mean, a lot of the movies, you know, that he did, these early comedies, when I knew him as a kid, he was in his more serious phase. And I would always want to ask him about... those comedies, you know. He sort of scoffed at them.
But he was good.
He was amazing.
He was so loose.
I know. Very modern. Very, you know, very kind of modern. He had an amazing life just in terms of his career. He was born in Georgia. And then he was in something called the Jesse Bonestell Players. He was with Ralph Bellamy and Gail Sondergaard.
Oh, my God.
So they traveled around. They did, you know.
I love Ralph Bellamy.
You imagine, like, little tent shows and just, like, the back ends of show business, and then, you know, made it to Broadway and discovered by Gloria Swanson and brought to Hollywood, and just an amazing career, but very funny, very literate.
Yeah.
And I love those, you know, those comedies.
And he was like Myrna Loy's, besides William Powell, a favorite leading man.
Yeah. And I talked about this experience with Jane Fonda, which was surreal. I was like, can you imagine being a kid like Myrna Loy's at the, like, because they lived right near each other, as did Paulette Goddard, as did Senia Hasso. They had done a play together called The Waltz of the Toreadors. But I would sit there at the dinner table with these, like, amazing women, you know, and I just would be, just think it was so
what was incredible. Myrna Loy like?
Oh, they would talk politics.
Yeah.
You know, that was always, it was very kind of serious. They never talked about movies, you know, and I would sit there and be like, oh my God, I want to ask about Mr. Blandings. Or, you know. And it was always about the current president and political situation. And, you know.
That's great. I'm happy to hear that.
But it was amazing. She was very sweet. And I remember, too, after my father had passed away, that she was incredibly nice. Wrote me a wonderful letter, as did Ralph Bellamy. And I thought that was, like, really, every once in a while, you know, I feel like sometimes I should bring in some of my memorabilia just to show people.
You should.
Well, like, because I had a friend over, and I have this.
And we won't sell any in the garage sale.
In the celebrity garage sale, which is my next idea.
To come.
But I was like, there's a letter from Myrna Loy. People like, oh my God.
Right.
I know.
Speaking of Ralph Bellamy, I got to tell you, when I did House Sitter with Frank Oz, who's a director I loved working with.
Yes.
Loved him. I was cast as Steve Martin's, like, you know, not the girl that ends up with him. And I said to him, it's the Ralph Bellamy role. And he said, you are right. It's the Ralph Bellamy role. So he called me Ralph through the whole movie.
Oh,
that was my
that's
name.
Great.
I said, it's Ralph Bellamy and His Girl Friday. That's the role. He goes, yeah.
He never got the girl.
Never got the girl.
Ralph Bellamy.
No. Mm-hmm.
But there, when we did the show, I don't know if you got to see any of it, but if you had any sort of, I thought that it was hard to pick out favorites, but I think the discussion that I had with Lee Grant about the Blacklist, it just blew my mind, you know, the idea that, I don't know, that this could still sort of happen, you know, that people, that, that women were blacklisted because their husbands were communists.
Right.
Right.
That, and that whole idea of that. And
just the association. Right.
And just the struggle of, we talked about this actress named Dorothy Comingore, who I had no idea of her story, that she was in the movie Citizen Kane. And
she was the wife, right?
Yeah.
And, or the mistress. The mistress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Susan Cain, mm-hmm. and that Hearst so despised her performance that he decided to ruin her career and went even as far as to, like, set up a phony thing. She got arrested for prostitution. I mean, just crazy stuff.
And then I'm sure Hedda Hopper helped him with all of
that. Oh, yeah. So literally, like, again, just, you know, put her in her place and ruined her career. And just that idea of, you know, for actresses, again, just this idea that sometimes it still feels like...
it still goes on.
I know.
Definitely.
It still feels like you're one inch away from, like, geez, don't be Dorothy Comingore here. Don't.
Yeah, no, it still goes on.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, we always think about things getting better, but, I mean, and they're saying that things getting better, but it's like, it doesn't really feel like that much better. It still feels like sexism is sort of rampant,
and also, you know, the whole discussion that's being held now because of Trump is, you know, sexual harassment.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure you've dealt with that. I've dealt with that in our business.
I call it being an actress. Yeah. I was like,
I call it being a human, being a woman.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And I mean, I'm glad that's coming out again. You know, I mean, Rose McGowan made that really firm statement about that.
Absolutely. I know. I was and it'll be interesting again with someone like Rose McGowan. It feels so awful as a woman to go, wow, I really admire her. Oh, jeez. Yeah. I never do that. Never going to work again. Right. Because I think we've all had that experience where, like, yeah, that's happened to me five or six times.
No, I've actually had a director say to me, you will never work in this town. I mean, he actually used that, and I was all of 24, and I thought, my career's over already?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's that, you know, that fear, and unless you can express to people, like, what it feels like when somebody says that, well, she never said anything, she never spoke up, it's like, who would believe you?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of these is, I have an actress friend who has a very, very famous person she did a movie with, and she had this experience, and she's like, we should all, like, name all these people, not to hurt them, but just to say, like, he did this to me. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, that ought to go over really well.
Right.
Like, you know, it just, you can't, you just, you still, it's so taboo that you can't.
Yeah.
I don't think you can talk about it. Yeah. Even the people who do it, I don't want to. I see them.
Mm-hmm.
My mom sees them. Mm-hmm. She goes, every time I see him on television.
Because you've told your mom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Every time I see him, I know. But it's like, yeah, what are you going to do? Ruin the guy's way? He's got to marry. He's got kids. And you feel a certain responsibility of, like, I'm here. I survived. But then the other part of you is really angry.
Yes.
And really rageful, and how much that sort of a, you know, was an upsetting experience, and why do you feel as a woman? I approach this a lot in my work, the self-victimization that
exactly.
women...
Exactly. That's the worst thing.
And I do a lot of that. I'm like, yeah. I probably deserved it. I probably did something that, you know, why do I want to hurt him?
Yeah, why did I put myself in that position?
Yeah. And, you know...
Oh, God, we got to stop talking about it.
All right. We're going to end on a more positive note. What are some of the things... You were just in the show, which I loved, called Hand of God.
Mm-hmm.
And but what are you working on these days?
I have a movie coming out called... it's actually funny how I got this job. It's called Literally Right Before Aaron, which is a handful.
Uh-huh.
And Ryan Eggold wrote and directed it, who stars on The Blacklist with James Spader.
Yes.
And I met him. This is fantastic. I did Hollywood Game Night. Do you ever watch
that? Oh, yes. Yeah,
with Jane Lynch?
Jane Lynch.
Sure. So Ryan, me, and Leah Thompson were a team.
Wow. Oh,
and fun. We were a good team, and our guy that we were playing for was so good and so smart, and the other team was bad, and they won, and I'm still pissed about it, because we should have won. And I felt bad for the guy, you know, because we were playing for
him. You were playing for,
yeah. But anyway, out of the blue, I get this call from my agent saying, Ryan Eggold wants you to be in his movie. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah. And I said, well, what is it? He wrote the script, and there's a part. It's just one scene. But, and I said, oh, and when Leah Thompson's in it. And I went, oh. He's putting the band back together.
Oh, that's great.
So I play Kobe Smulders. I keep wanting to say Colby. Kobe Smulders' mother, and Leah Thompson plays Justin Long's mother.
All righty. And when does this movie?
I think next year.
Did you ever play like a Southerner?
I have played Southerners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could see you doing like, as suddenly as you were talking, I sort of projected on you like you were making pies or something.
That's
what
funny.
About a musical? Did you see the musical, The Waitress?
No, I haven't seen it yet. Oh. Is it good?
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Okay, so did you, having done, you know, Grace of My Heart, you must have seen Beautiful.
Yes, I did. And wonderful. There are so many, I love Carole King, and there's so many other great stories out of the Brill Building. All the singer songwriters out of that. I love the Brill Building.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, Dana, thank you so much for being here, and please
come back
anytime you have a project or you want to talk about movies, we're here.
Yes, we are. Her website is danadelaney.com.
Actually, there's Nesco longer. I'm just on Twitter.
You're just on Twitter?
I'm just on Twitter.
Strike that. Simpler. She's just on Twitter, at Dana Delaney. Thank you so much, Dana, for being with us. You can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper.
And definitely, it's a good read. Buy it.
It is. It's so good. It's now out on paperback. And also look at our page on Facebook. Check out our website, ileanaspodcast.com.
Absolutely. And if you want us to start doing Celebrity Garage Sale, let me know, because I'll start bringing in things.
We're going
to
be talking
from
about
my
that.
Closet.
I'm
and props for movies. We'll start selling them for charity.
Yep,
if people are interested, I might have a little, you know, a few trinkets from Goodfellas.
Oh,
just saying.
Dangle that
so
out there.
I am going to say, as we always do, everyone's life is a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is our end. Thanks. Thank you. Have a good day.
See you next time.
Yay.
Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, Christian Harloff, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.
From producers Maria Menounos.